special report.
So my name is Dr. Mike Klumpner. I have been in public safety for 24 years.
We spoke with Mike over a year ago, and we talked about active shooters and what to do. We also sent it out into the world for free. It became one of the most listened to segments that we've ever done on EMRAP, and it's time for a follow-up.
I've spent 21 years in the fire service. I'm currently a career fire captain. I've been a paramedic for 21 years, spent 9.5 years working on a helicopter at a level one trauma center in South Carolina. I've been a sworn law enforcement officer for 7 years with my whole career assigned to the SWAT team with a large urban law enforcement agency. I've also completed my PhD in Homeland Security Policy. I wrote my dissertation on integrated police fire EMS response to active shooter events. So I've been studying and teaching about active shooters since 2007. I've been fortunate to present on 4 continents and 300 conferences, and I've trained about 40,000 responders in the last 2 years. So my whole focus has been on the integrated police fire EMS response to these events. But in addition to learning how to respond to these events, I had to step back and really examine the psychology of these shooters. And so I've spent about 4,000 to 5,000 hours now studying active shooters and the response events.
So you're obviously the guy to talk to. Now, we spoke with you, I don't know, a year or two ago on MRAP, and a segment that sort of went viral both in the medical community and outside of it. What has changed since then? You've had more events, unfortunately, to examine. The summary of that lecture that you gave us then was, if you are caught in an active shooter event, and tell me if I'm wrong, you should either 1, run as fast as you can, 2, hide as well as you can, or 3, fight as well as you can, because this is a life and death situation. Has that aspect of what you teach changed?
No, sir, it hasn't. That has remained a constant through all of this. One thing that I would tell people is you are indeed correct that these events have been increasing in both frequency and lethality of the events. We've seen these perpetrators doing more and more what we call asymmetric type of attack tactics, where they're using improvised explosive devices. They may be barricading doors. They may be using chemical munitions, throwing smoke bombs. They're doing something in addition to just using ballistics, just using firearms. So we've seen these events becoming more complex. And obviously the event that happened recently in San Bernardino was very changing for us because this was 2 perpetrators in a well-planned attack. So we've seen these attacks increase, but I really have to tell you this, Mel. We can't look at this as a Chicken Little, sky is falling type of thing. I know there's some information going on that, you know, we're averaging a mass killing every single day now. And what I tell your listeners is we haven't seen that dramatic of an increase in the last 2 years. What we saw, people adopting a new definition to active shooter. So previously, what has been recognized in federal law enforcement communities is the definition of an active shooter where 3 or more people were shot in a public place in the absence of gang or drug activity, or in the absence of a commission of a secondary crime, such as a bank robbery. So when we followed that definition, what we were really looking at is someone who comes in and is making a statement with mass violence to people that they don't know at all, completely random event. And when we stick with that definition, we see that we're still holding about 15 incidences a year. What happened is we kind of went sideways on the definition, and people took the definition of a mass shooting event, which is 4 or more people shot in one place without the absence of a cooling off period, like you would see with serial killers. So they took the definition of a mass shooting and adapted that to active shooter incidences. And so the issue that I have with all of this is there's 2 different things. So I was just pulling up some numbers as well that came out of a study last year. So if we look at the 4 or more people shot in a public place, 40% of those incidences are directly related to gang or drug activity. The other thing that I want to talk about is when people say that, you know, we're having these mass killings happening every single day, you know, 4 or more people shot. Again, 40% of mass killings in the United States are familicides. That's when typically a male spouse kills his female spouse and kills their children. So yes, we do have a lot of mass killings in the United States, but I always tell people, you know, 80% of the mass killings just right away either happen in your own home or happens with gang and drug activity going on. So then we can kind of look at the other 20% and we keep delving way down and we get into about a 2% number, which is this active shooter that we really fear, like the San Bernardino and Umpqua Community College and places like that, where we have perpetrators who are coming in and making a statement of extreme violence. Typically, they don't have a grudge against people. They're just coming in to kill as many as they can in a short amount of time.
Part of the base sort of fear of this is that the average person feels like there's nothing we can do. There's just nothing you can do. So short of sort of a political statement about whether people should or shouldn't be carrying their own guns, what can people do? Is there anything that you can do to protect yourself from these events?
Absolutely. And you're exactly right. You know, everyone wants to look at the low-hanging fruit, which is, you know, gun control. But one of the biggest things is if you see something, say something, tell law enforcement. And we can go back and look at John Ledoux in Wisconsin. He was planning a massive attack against his combined middle school and high school. He was the person who was building the explosives in the storage unit. And the lady who lived next door to the storage unit just happened to see him in there late at night doing something. She reported him as a suspicious person. Law enforcement came to the storage unit, went in, walked up on Ledoux. He's sitting there, he's making bombs, and he was a very good bomb maker. He had three large bombs that were pressure cooker bombs. Each one was three times larger than the one used at the Boston Marathon, and he was planning on using that in his school. Police officers walked up and said, "What are you doing?" John Ledoux, very matter of fact, said, "What do you think I'm doing?" And one of the cops jokingly said, "It looks like you're making bombs." And John said, "We need to talk." And that stopped a massive rampage that was getting ready to happen simply because one person saw something that didn't look right and reported it. And we've seen some of these other terrorism attacks here in the United States thwarted because just an average citizen saw something that just didn't seem right and reported it, and people were able to follow up on it. So I always say this, you know, be very aware of your surroundings, be vigilant. A lot of times what we have seen is these perpetrators who do these true active shooter events, they are doing intelligence gathering on these locations. You will have seen them before. People will have seen these people either coming through the location, scoping the location out, and we see that time and time again. And I like this phrase I heard the other day. I attended a lecture that was just on this and was a retired CIA operator talking. And he said, when they've gone back and looked at these incidences, they've looked at the video footage of this person in there. And in every situation, someone gave this person what he called the stink eye. They looked at him. This person just didn't seem like they belonged, but the person who gave him the stink eye just went about their business. And so he's talking about, you know, following up on your gut instinct. If you see something and it's, or someone, and it's just not sitting right in your gut, you need to act upon that.
Yeah, it seems to me to be a very difficult weighing of how you do that without becoming a sort of a civilian-induced police state. I don't like the way you look. I don't like the way you cut me off on the freeway. F*** you, I'm calling the cops. You're a bad guy. How do you hold that tension of, yes, we should be vigilant versus we're all human, and so there's that'll piss us off? And
yeah, I understand exactly what you're saying. And what this really boils down to is being involved in your community, knowing what should be there and what shouldn't be there. And I was using a great example talking the other day to some people. One of our best community watchers are the mothers that wait at the school bus stops in the morning in their cars with their kids. They could tell you exactly who's supposed to be at bus stops and who's not because they're involved in their community. They know what's going on. So we need people who are out there and understand the difference between someone who, you know, is involved in the community and should be there versus someone who just doesn't fit in. And so you're exactly right. We don't want to encourage a spirit of vigilantes everywhere. But as a law enforcement officer, I can tell you we really need for people to tell us when something just doesn't look right. Because we may wade through 100, we may wade through 1,000 of those. But if we get to the one that stops a mass attack or a terrorist event, it is well worth it for us.
So let's go back then to your three pearls from your lecture. And can you sort of expand out a little more? I gave the bullet points, run as fast as you can, hide, fight. So within that framework, can you tell us what that actually means? An active shooter event has started. Aren't I a coward if I get up and run?
Absolutely not. And the thing that we know, these perpetrators know once they start shooting that they're on the clock. They know that there is a massive response coming to stop them. And one thing I got to tell you, Mel, this is such an important statistic that we tell our law enforcement officers, and this is a scary statistic. Once the shooting starts, there is an average serious injury or person killed every 15 seconds until the shooter stops. And typically the shooter stops one of about three ways. The shooter kills themselves, which happens about 40% of the time. The shooter is stopped by law enforcement, which happens about 40% of the time, or about the other 20% of the time the shooter leaves the situation. So that number, that perpetrator knows that they're attempting to kill a lot of people very quickly, but public safety knows that we need to get there very quickly. So when we have someone, if you want to use the analogy of yourself, you're faced with this person, if you turn around and run, typically these perpetrators are not chasing you. You become a harder target by turning around and running. They're looking for people who aren't running, and they're looking for a large number of body count as quickly as possible. So indeed, you are absolutely not a coward. You're doing the best thing that can save your life.
Okay, so then hiding. What are the tricks to hiding? Is it just like hopping behind a door? Is there tricks to this part of it?
There are certainly things that you want to consider. So we don't want you to just hide behind a curtain or hide behind something that's not going to stop a bullet. We want you to hide behind something that hopefully is going to stop a bullet and behind a locked door. Again, like I told you, these people, they may be going down a hallway, and if it's in the hospital and we're in the office area of the hospital, they're trying door after door. If the door's locked, they keep on moving. Now, the side to that, if they do stop on someone, typically that's going to be a revenge type of shooting. They are looking for a particular individual. But as these people go down, they try these doors and they're locked. They're not shooting their way in. They're not forcing their way in. They keep moving and moving and moving, looking for an easy target. So we want someone to quickly get behind a locked door, turn out the lights, shut the blinds, silence your phone. If you can see the perpetrator, if you have the opportunity to let 911 know where they are, that's important information for us. But one thing I got to tell you, Mel, people are anticipating and expecting that 911 operators are going to pick up the phone. When we go back and look at some of these events, we can look at the Virginia Tech shooting. There were two campus dispatchers that handled 2,027 911 calls that came into the campus center. At the Aurora Theater shooting, 13 dispatchers handled 6,000 911 calls that came in. There was a hospital shooting in the Texas area, and they ended up having 800 people call into their PBX operator and an additional 200 people call into 911. So all these calls are going to immediately overwhelm the 911 system. So if you are hiding and you're trying to reach out to 911, you may not get a quick response.
So now let's go to the fight part. And I want to have this in two sections. One is, there's been some politicians and other people getting up and saying, if a shooter is headed towards me, I'm going to be a hero and I'm going to get my buddies and we're going to go and chase after this person. Is that good advice?
Well, there was a very small study. It was about 16 active shooter incidences. And in those 16 active shooter incidences, civilians attacked the shooter in four of those incidences, and they overwhelmed the perpetrator and subdued the perpetrator. And in none of those four cases were the civilians injured. Now, I have to absolutely caveat to you that we had stories of heroes out of these recent active shooter events where people have confronted shooters and they have lost their lives for it. So what I would tell you is we want to attack in a couple different circumstances. Number one, if we are immediately confronted with an armed perpetrator, they turn the corner and you're standing face to face with a gun and you don't have the option to run, you don't have the option to hide, you need to fight because your life depends on it. Number two, if someone jumps on the perpetrator, then everyone jump on the perpetrator. We want to jump in the fight and we want to do everything we can to subdue these people. And then last, if you have the opportunity to take down this perpetrator using the advantage of surprise, they don't see you coming, you're standing behind a door, you have a fire extinguisher, and you're able to administer that fire extinguisher therapeutically against their cranium, that would be an opportunity.
They are my questions, but what does Mike want to tell us?
For all of our friends out there in the medical field, I do have some things that I want to talk about when we talk about hospital response to the active shooter events. One of the big things that I've taken a personal crusade is this code silver code system that hospitals are using to announce an active shooter event. I have a lot of heartburn about using a code word to discuss a life-threatening security situation in your hospital. And I want every hospital administrator, and hopefully if there's any hospital attorneys, to please listen right now. You need to consider the liability that you are bringing upon yourself by not adequately warning people in the hospital that there is a deadly event happening. If, say, for example, Mel, you were with your family and you're on the first floor, you're headed to the cafeteria and you hear code silver in the cafeteria. to an average citizen, you have no clue what that means. That could mean that you need more dishes in the cafeteria. So you and your family walk unsuspectingly into the cafeteria and you may die. If that situation happens, there is a liability on the hospital for not warning people about the threat. So a lot of hospitals are transitioning away from code silver and they're using this plain text. I grabbed one of them that I saw that I liked, and this is the quote. A life-threatening security situation is occurring in the emergency department. Take shelter behind a locked door immediately. That is a good warning that you need to have out there. It warns everyone that something is happening. And in addition, what I tell people is, if I was there at the hospital as a police officer and I hear that you have a life-threatening security situation happen in your emergency department, do you know where I'm going? I'm going to your emergency department. I'm going to see what I can do to help out. You say that you have an active shooter in your labor and delivery unit, it doesn't matter where I am, I'm going there to help out as a police officer. So I really want hospitals to keep in mind that the danger of using this type of code silver or code gray, whatever terminology you want to use to try and mask the fact that you have an active shooter event. This is not the time to mask anything. You need to be telling people to take cover immediately. One of the other things that I want to talk about is we've gone back and I've done a lot of consulting with hospitals. And when you actually talk to hospital staff about what they're going to do in an active shooter situation, many of these hospital staff members are completely unaware. And the problem with that is their job responsibilities or the activities they do in the hospital don't fit in to the active shooter lockdown plan that the hospital has. A great example of this, if you have a staff that frequently transition between units, such as residents, respiratory therapists, and they're frequently on the move throughout the hospital, they're not in a typical unit that locks down. They may be in transition between units. If they're in a long hallway, where are they going to go? What if you have staff that are on break in the cafeteria? Do they know where to go for a lockdown? How about staff that are entering or leaving the building during shift change? This happened in Palm Bay, Florida at the Palm Bay Hospital shooting on November 4th in 2010. The event happened at 1:40 in the afternoon. It was a shooting that happened in the kitchen, and the environmental services shift change occurred at 2 p.m. And so there were numerous employees coming into the building, heading right towards the kitchen, completely unaware that there was any type of event going on, and nor did they have any plan in place for what they would do if this event occurred when they're not in their normal workspace. So that's one thing that I always want hospital staff to just talk about. You know, what would I do if I was transferring an intubated patient from the emergency department up to the ICU and we step off the elevator on the third floor and all of a sudden we hear shooting? What are we going to do? Where are we going to take this patient? Do we get back on the elevator? Those are things to think about. One of the other things is we've seen this time and time again, that hospitals have a lot of difficulty sending out timely and correct information to staff regarding the situation. Going back and looking at some of these events, hospitals have either not put out any information or hospitals have put out completely erroneous information. So most of the staff members in these hospitals in just about every single event said that they got the majority of their information either from social media or they got it from news stations via their phone. That's where all the information came from. So I encourage hospitals, you know, sometimes if you don't have any information, we say we don't have any information. It's perfectly fine to say, continue lockdown, we still have a problem. That's fine to say, but you need to let people know what the updates are for the situation. A couple other things to consider. I've read several hospital plans, and their hospital plans say that if they have people shot in their hospital, that as soon as possible, take these injured people down to the emergency department where they will be stabilized and then head up to surgery or wherever. I have to caution everybody, 30% of hospital shootings occur in the emergency department. So if you're writing into your plan, hey, take the injured to the emergency department, your emergency department may be completely off limits. And we saw an event that happened at this Texas hospital. The Texas Rangers closed the emergency department for 9 hours for the investigation. And that emergency department was the only level one trauma center serving about 5 or 6 counties. So the whole emergency department was off limits. So again, this is something that hospital administrators need to keep in mind. If you have a shooting that transitions from one part of your hospital into the emergency department, where are you going to take these patients within your hospital? Do you take them up to surgery for them to be triaged? Where are you going to take them that's alternate to your emergency department if you cannot reach your emergency department?
So the point on that is that there's no one right answer, but each individual hospital just has to come up with the alternative locations where they can look after patients.
Absolutely. And what I would recommend for hospitals is take the time to play the what if game and figure out what they would do. You certainly want to play the what if game when you're sitting around a conference table rather than the situation actually occurring. One of the other main issues that we have seen is these PBX phone systems at the hospital. You may have a 75-year-old retired grandma who's working the PBX phone system. Has she actually been trained on what to do when 600 people are calling her saying that there is a shooter in the hospital and they want to know if they should run, hide, or fight. We saw this as a great example of a hospital shooting case, and the PBX operator had never been trained in this, nor did she have any clue what to tell them. And she had never been that overwhelmed on the PBX system. And then the other issue was she was getting information from these people in the hospital who were seeing the shooter, but yet she never took that information and was relaying it to law enforcement. And that was one of the things that came out in the after action report. Staff were taught in an emergency, call the internal hospital emergency number, which was ringing to the PBX operator. So a lot of the law enforcement officers who were responding from outside the hospital, they had no clue about any of this information.
Mike, thanks for your time. Sadly, we'll probably have to speak with you more in the future about these topics.
It's absolutely my pleasure. And any time that you want to chat about any type of event, anything that's going on, I would be more than happy to take some time because I know the message is important. I know you have a large audience that wants to hear some information.